All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and this is going to be a show that runs like a finely tuned machine today, all right, because we've got so much to bring you. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Edward Baptist, professor of history at Cornell University and author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, and we're going to be talking about his op-ed piece that appeared in the Los Angeles Times yesterday. It was called Forgiveness Won't End Racism in America. Before that, we'll be joined by Ron Davis, the father of Jordan Davis, who was killed by an armed white racist in 2012. And Ron is going to be traveling around the country speaking out against the murder of black people by police and armed vigilantes. And he's also featured in the film 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. So I'm looking forward to that. But opening the show up, I'm going to bring you right now, actually, an interview that I did with Mark Silver, the award-winning documentary filmmaker and director of 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. And that was a film that won a very special jury prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And his first film was Who is Diana Kristal, which we featured on the show back when it first came out. Now, to start, I want to give you just a little taste of the film. So check this out.
Fire rescue Carter, the address of your emergency.
I'm at the Gate gas station.
Shots fired in the parking lot.
Two black males stepped out.
Came from the red SUV.
I don't know if they were trying to smash something.
The person driving the vehicle was the one shooting out of the vehicle.
It was like pop, 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 pop. Second here, pop, 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 pop.
Michael Dunn, he's being charged with shooting and killing 17-year-old Jordan Davis.
The confrontation began over loud music.
Was there music playing in the car?
Yes.
What type of music?
Rap.
Did the defendant say anything about the music?
Oh, I hate that thug music.
Thug is the new N-word. You've just seen four black kids.
I'm not racist. They're racist.
Michael Dunn is claiming self-defense.
Jordan Davis threatened Michael Dunn.
Because you're dead, bitch.
I look, and I'm looking at a barrel.
This is about the right of everyone to protect themselves, protect their family.
Under the law, it's justified.
I said, you're not going to kill me, you son of a bitch.
There's no weapons in that car.
It could have been just a stick.
Could it have been your imagination?
It stick. Well, no. I mean, anything's possible, I guess.
Maybe they didn't have a gun, but he thought they had a gun.
They think it's a gun when it's in the hands of a young African-American.
Trayvon Martin's father texts me, I just want to welcome you to a club that none of us want to be in.
It's going to be open season.
Open
season.
You can
say later that maybe he did have it.
It's time to pick up where Dr. King left off.
I've never covered a trial with this much international attention.
This was a 21st century lynching.
Was he all right to kill my son?
What happened to Jordan? What happened to Jordan?
That was the trailer from the film 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. At this year's Sundance, I saw a film that I have to tell you just really just burrowed its way into my head, knocked me back in my seat, and it stayed with me ever since. It was a very powerful film. It's called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. And it tells the story of what happened on November 23rd, 2012, which is sort of, you know, ironically is called Black Friday. It's the day after Thanksgiving. It's the start of the festive holiday season. But that year, that night, four black teenagers went out to do what teenagers do, ride around, listen to the music, have fun, look for something to do. Just happy that they were alive. And a short few minutes after they pulled into a gas station, a convenience store, to get some gum and a pack of cigarettes, a white man in the parking lot pulled out a gun. Well, first he complained about their loud music. Then he pulled out a gun and fired 10 shots, 10 bullets into the car, murdering one of the occupants of the car. And that young man's name was Jordan Davis. And this film, I'm telling you folks, it's a remarkably powerful film. And it's done by the director, Mark Silver, who, when you were listening to the show a little while ago, was on talking about his other film, one of his other films, Who is Diana Kristal? And he brings the same power, the same soul, the same just really, really impactful search for truth to this film. And I want to welcome him back to the show. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure. Let's jump into this. How did you come to this story, man? This was a, you know, there was a lot going on around this subject of police murder and whatnot, but you were drawn to this story. What brought you there?
Well, we actually first met Jordan's parents a couple of weeks before the George Zimmerman verdict. And at that point, we spent a week with them in Jacksonville, where the shooting happened, where Jordan's dad lived, and Atlanta, where Jordan's mum lived. We spent a week together. We talked about what happened to Jordan, and then specifically what happened during these 3.5 minutes where the two cars pulled up next to each other. At that point, the reason we kind of zoomed in on this particular family and this particular story was because we saw what happened in that 3.5 minutes as the kind of perfect storm of racial profiling, access to guns, and then laws that give people the confidence to use those guns. As the film evolved and the edit evolved, suddenly all these other cases happened. Ferguson happened, and then, as we all know, many other shootings happened. And suddenly, that 3.5 minutes wasn't just about what happened to Jordan Davis, but it became metaphorical for what happened in all these other cases. And what the film then spoke to was what was common about all of these things.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because one of the things that strikes me is you have so many people killed by the police, so many people, just particularly young black people, murdered by the police. You think about this, and this story also brings out something that happens as well, and probably even more frequently than most of us know. And there's a tie between the kind of society that would condone the police murder of black people and a society that would condone and even enshrine laws that allow the outright murder of black youth, black people.
Yeah, and I think for us, I can understand there's certain political kind of pundits that don't want to make connections or actively want to express that there aren't connections between all of these things. But for us, I think the DNA, if you like, of what is the same in all of these cases is why predominantly white men are fearful of black men. Like, where does that come from? And particularly in Michael Dunn, where I believe that he believed that he saw a gun. Now, clearly there wasn't a gun, the police never found a gun, there was never any evidence that there was a gun. And I think that question of how is it that somebody like Michael Dunn can be so conditioned to think that he saw a gun, I think that's a question that isn't just for citizens, but of course is also for police in many of these cases.
We're going to come back to that in a minute, because I did want to start first with sort of the way you told the story, which you've just been hinting at somewhat. You let both of these people just unroll. You allowed them to actually have the space to tell these stories. You had Michael Dunn, the killer, who got up and he told his story. And then you had the story of Jordan Davis, who he was, and that had to be told through friends and family. But in that, you know, and I have to tell you, because my first inclination would have been, my thing would have been, Michael Dunn, racist killer, Jordan Davis, innocent youth. Now, there's truth to that. But you didn't just sort of heavy hammer it on people. You allowed it to unfold. And that was a really powerful way. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I felt it was really important for as long as possible during the film for the audience to almost feel like they were members of the jury. That the information that the audience would receive during the film would be the same as what the jury received. And in that way, I think it gives an audience a greater chance or opportunity to actually reflect on, if you like, their own biases. Like, could they actually see anything of themselves in Michael Dunn? And I thought, rather than make him this kind of boogeyman character from the outset, there was more value for audiences when it comes to considering their own potential, whether like conscious or subconscious biases. And I think lots of people have said that in a very strange way, they felt some form of empathy for Michael Dunn at points in that film. Obviously, as we learn more about him, his racist views become more overt during the film, then that empathy quickly disappears. But I think there's great value in this idea that I believe that some audience members would, at the very least, have some feeling of connection or understanding about this idea that Michael Dunn felt fearful when he pulled up next to this car with four black youths playing loud hip-hop. And I think the way that we constructed the film allows people to question whether they would have felt that fear, and then subsequently question why is it that they feel that fear.
And then it draws them into, though, they have to face when things turn around, and you listen to a brilliant move, the thing about the phone calls. That was incredible, I have to tell you. That was really great, and I want you to talk about that, because that actually allowed him to basically lay out all of his ugly crap.
Yeah, it was very interesting because we couldn't get access to Michael Dunn in terms of an interview with him or his family. They didn't want to be in the film. But we did have a kind of variety of other jigsaw puzzle pieces, so to speak. So one of them was the initial police interview that was done with Michael Dunn about 24 hours after the shooting. And then because in the state of Florida, we were able to access Michael Dunn's phone calls from prison, which are all recorded, to his fiancée, Rhonda Rauer. And we started listening to those phone calls. And again, they were hugely revealing in the sense that Michael Dunn never believed that he did anything wrong. And he frequently expressed this in these phone calls. So perhaps actually it worked well for the film that we weren't able to directly interview him. And in a way, we got something that was much more honest by hearing these phone calls between him and his fiancée about how he felt there was a major wrongdoing in that he was even being charged with this crime because he so firmly believed that it was a case of self-defense.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with film director Mark Silver, and he's the director of a really powerful, really important new film that everybody has got to see and spread around. All right, it's called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Mark, what becomes clear, too, in that whole telephone scenario there, one of the things that keeps happening, and as you're saying, he allows all this. He just flowers in a certain amount. You really see the internalizing of all this racist stuff that's in there. And the idea that he even talks about good citizens, and he talks about the idea that basically if he hadn't killed Jordan Davis, then maybe Jordan Davis would have gone out and killed somebody else right after that. You're watching it and you're thinking, what the hell, man?
Incredible. Yeah, he believes, I think, that he saved other people's lives by killing Jordan Davis. And there's another incredible line by him, which when you're in the cinema, you always hear a gasp from the audience, that he compares himself to a rape victim who is being blamed because she was wearing a skimpy short skirt or something. But what I found most interesting about those types of comments was the way that Michael Dunn almost became a metaphor for parts of America being blind to their own racism. And that's why I felt that Michael Dunn was such a powerful character in the film. Obviously, there's what's on the surface as he's giving testimony and all of these phone calls and his initial police interview. But much more deeply, I think he came to represent something much more powerful.
And then you even see that when he talks about, actually, when a lot of people talk about this, and you had made the point that race itself was not allowed to be in the courtroom. It was present in the courtroom anyway, but it was also present in the streets. But there was a thing that was going on as well, which was really very heavy. You have this whole thing of the description, especially by white people, of the trial as the loud music trial or the thug music trial or whatever. But it was all about some kid that played his music too loud and that'll teach him, and it deserves death. And that strikes deep in your heart, man, because you're thinking, what the hell is this?
Yeah, there's a scene in the film where we hear voices from people in Jacksonville who are calling into a radio chat show, and someone actually says that why was this even called the loud music trial? Why wasn't it called the 21st century lynching trial?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Powerful words. Yeah, and this idea that race wasn't allowed to be discussed in the courtroom. So that was in some pre-trial hearings, the defense lawyer had basically said that because Michael Dunn wasn't charged with any hate crime, because he wasn't heard using any words of hatred when it came to race, that race was not allowed to be discussed in the courtroom. And on top of that, Jordan Davis wasn't allowed to be referred to as a victim during the trial, because by calling him a victim, it would have implied that Michael Dunn had done something wrong, and that would have altered the jury's mind. Obviously, as I realized that there was this massive juxtaposition between how the case was discussed inside the courthouse, where there was no mention of race, and then on the streets outside and on the airwaves of Jacksonville, everyone obviously was perceiving this as this would never have happened if this was a car full of four white teenagers that Michael Dunn had pulled up next to.
Mm-hmm. And that challenge to people who were following the trial, who were actually looking at it, and the challenge to people who view your film now in terms of even the television coverage of from inside the courtroom, which again was also astounding and really refreshing and important because it allowed that to unfold. And that challenge, you had to deal with that thing of Dunn's claim to be just, and his sense of entitlement to just be a fine, upstanding American and who's, hey, I got a good life. I live on the beach. I'm an engineer. And this and this and that. And this black kid whose story is only really told, and it's told very powerfully by the testimony of his friends, both in the courtroom and outside, and his mom and dad. And they're the people that are just laying their hearts out and saying, wait a minute, we're human. And it was those two poles that was, no, they're animals that deserve to be penned up and killed if they threaten us. And then, no, we're human. Very powerfully posed.
I think that is very important in films that are about inequality and human rights that we try and decrease the differences between people and try and break down these constructions of otherness and race so that we can see each other just simply as human beings. And Ron and Lucy, Jordan's parents, that's how they wanted to bring Jordan up. That's how they did bring Jordan up. And I think in the way that they speak since his murder, they're almost still parenting Jordan in his absence. And I think one of the things that we tried to do was, how do you show who Jordan was, given that obviously we never got to meet him? And you get to learn who Jordan was in his absence through understanding who his parents really are, who his friends were who were in the car with him, and also his girlfriend who happened to see him that night for the very last time. And through meeting all of these other people that obviously surrounded Jordan when he was alive, you get to realize that the impression of Jordan from Michael Dunn couldn't be further from the truth.
And what they learned too, what all of his friends learned, for instance, and who was the young man talking about the loud music question? And he said, they called it thug music, and that's simply another word for calling me an N. You know, these days it's acceptable to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd loved hanging out with his friends because they just told it as it was. There was nothing academic. We didn't speak to any specialists on race or anything like this. We just spoke to 17-year-old boys who understood that there was a certain sector, if you like, of society that felt that they should be presented in this certain way, and they were having none of that. Even when Michael Dunn on the stand, he claimed that he never used the word thug music and he called it rap crap. And you know, one of these boys just ripped that apart and just said rap crap. And he made that up when he was in prison because he knows now thug music has certain connotations.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the director, Mark Silver, and he's the director of a great new film called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Mark, your heart had to break at the outcome of the first trial, where there was a partial mistrial. And you're looking at that and you're thinking, how did this happen? But then I realized one of the things that you've done in there is that through your camera and the focusing on the trial and the way you said you wanted the audience to actually be jurors, we also had to deal with the fact that you painted a picture of an entire society that's actually built around this and that allows us and accepts this kind of judgment, that accepts this kind of view of Black and other people of color.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was actually just thinking while you were saying that. I remember being in Jacksonville and thinking a lot about The Wire and how the different series of The Wire looked at different structural elements, the media or education or race, and how when all of those things come together, we start to understand maybe like a wider perspective on things. But in many ways, yeah, when the first verdict came in and a mistrial was declared, the tragedy is that standing there in the courtroom when that happened, I'd like to think I couldn't understand how that actually happened, but the tragedy was that I could understand, because the system inside the courthouse was set up in such a way that, A, if race isn't allowed to be discussed, that's one thing, but watching the defense lawyer and the prosecution do their thing over a couple of weeks in court, I realized that actually it was very ironic. The seal of Florida was above the judge's head and it says, "In God we trust," on this seal of Florida. And I looked at that at times and I'm watching the defense and the prosecution express themselves. And I thought, you know, I'm not so sure this is about "In God we trust," rather than it might actually be who tells a better story in this courtroom is going to be the winner. And watching the defense lawyer, I can absolutely understand. He was so good. All he had to do was sow enough reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury that, of course, it was going to lead to a mistrial. And I think he was extremely successful. He didn't succeed in the sense that Michael Dunn was found not guilty. But I think given the circumstances, he totally did the best job he possibly could and sowed enough reasonable doubt in that jury's mind that it led to a mistrial. And, you know, when you start understanding the system, so to speak, in that way, yeah, I was tragically not surprised that that was the verdict.
Yeah, it's an important point. And it fits with this thing I was just thinking about, because there's this element of how you also revealed through the contrast and the interplay of both sides to what was going on, you revealed the nature of the entire society. And I was telling you a little earlier before we came in here about the Border Patrol being exonerated from all these shootings on the border of totally innocent people, kids throwing rocks. And it was okay to do that, you know. And the same thing that actually happens here, you know, you see this in the trial. It was not that far removed from the George Zimmerman murder of Trayvon Martin, the acquittal of Zimmerman and all that. This whole idea that this is the right of the good citizens to stand up and just have to hold on and do what they can to keep things under control. And it reminds you very seriously, there's too many good Germans in this country
who refuse to stand up and recognize what's going on and say anything. There is society-wide a kind of fashioning of a foundation for this kind of fascistic wing in society.
Sure, and it's branded as democracy and freedom, and it's like fascism with a smile sometimes.
Yeah.
Once you start looking at all of these elements, you understand that this kind of brand identity of post-racial America is clearly not the case.
Yeah. The idea of stand your ground, which was another really important element in the film and in the case, and the idea that they didn't have to prove anything other than he believed all this, and he did believe all this. He believed everything he had conjured up, which doesn't say what he did was right or excusable, but when you look at the system that says that's enough to get an innocent verdict.
Yeah, and obviously that prompts the question about how is it that people are conditioned to get to a point in their lives where they are capable of believing that. And I think that is the, if you like, maybe like the bigger question of the film, and why the film connects to all of these other shootings that have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's heavy because you're sitting there and you're watching this and you're thinking, okay, he actually believes this, and there's an entire society that believes this. I mean, look, after Trayvon Martin, after the verdict in the Zimmerman case and the murder of Trayvon was completely whitewashed and allowed, and then all these other, the string of murders that happens, and then you have Jordan Davis and the trial goes on, you have Ferguson erupt, you have Garner in New York, who's just standing there screaming, I can't breathe, as the cops are filmed strangling him. And you think that all these people that are saying, I believed he was going to hurt me, I believed he was armed, I believed this, I believed that. And it's not just justifying the individual acts, it's justifying the whole view.
Yeah, it's funny when you speak about the whole view, there were points in the edit, I remember with the editor, that about halfway through the edit, where I suddenly realized that you're right, the film is a metaphor for much bigger things. And one of those things suddenly became, we were talking about weapons of mass destruction, and this idea that Michael Dunn's lawyer was criticizing the police for not doing a good enough job by not being able to find the gun. And there was a moment where I thought about weapons of mass destruction and the fact that it's almost the same kind of thinking, that the individual level of what Michael Dunn said about essentially fearing the other and shooting in self-defense in a preemptive strike so that he wouldn't have got hurt himself was not so dissimilar to going to look for weapons that don't exist in another country, shooting in self-defense and being scared of these other people that we don't understand. I understand that that's a, you know, metaphorical leap, so to speak, but I, you know, in my heart, I feel there are connections between Michael Dunn as an individual and, if you like, you know, US foreign, we could take it all the way up to US foreign policy. And I think that is very interesting when you can make a film about essentially what happened to one family in a very kind of micro forensic way, as it is, as we follow this trial. But actually, in your heart, you start feeling that this is connected to much bigger things.
They actually do. They have this sense of entitlement that the world is theirs to conquer and hold on to. When you think about the imperialists that run this society and try to rule the world and have pretty much ruled the world for a long period of time, they have no problem going and overthrowing governments, drones taking people out all the time, all these kinds of things happening because they view it as their world and what they say goes. And there's us and them. And it's a very, very heavy thing because that's what the foundation for what happened to Jordan Davis was.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, that's what I'm trying to highlight or bring attention to, or, you know, and just inspire people to just look at that kind of construct from a slightly different perspective or angle.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the director, Mark Silver, and he's the director of a great new film called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Mark, let's look at this real quick. What do you think when the verdict came in of not guilty, and then there was a retrial a short while later, I guess, and the verdict came in as guilty, and you're looking at this guy, and you could see Michael Dunn was stunned. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. You had to wonder what really changed, and I don't get the sense that it was so much what changed in the courtroom as what was going on outside. What do you think of that?
Two things. Ferguson happened in between those two trials, and I like to think that perhaps the second jury had been affected by what happened in Ferguson and actually did think that Black Lives do matter, and that had shifted their perspective, that, you know, they sat through that trial and they came to the conclusion that clearly he was, you know, 100% guilty. Unfortunately, I also, that perspective slightly warped by the fact that the second trial, Michael Dunn didn't have the same defense lawyer, and I think that perhaps the second defense lawyer was maybe not as good as the first defense lawyer, and that second lawyer wasn't able to sow as much reasonable doubt as the first lawyer had. But yeah, obviously I prefer to think that maybe that second jury, their views were more evolved than the first jury.
I wanted to ask you this. Jordan Davis's dad, Ron Davis, said that Trayvon Martin's father called him and left him a message that said, "I want to welcome you to a club that none of us are happy to belong to." Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a very powerful moment in the film. And actually, even when Jordan was alive, he turned around to his father and said, when he saw Trayvon's picture on the news, how similar he felt he looked to Trayvon, and obviously how prophetic that turned out to be. And since this happened to Ron, Ron has subsequently gone to other families and welcomed them into this club that no parent wants to be a part of. And again, of course, this is a massive thing that I would imagine that most, if not all, black parents have to have this kind of conversation with their children at the moment. And even if they're not having the conversation with their children are seeing representations of themselves on the news and seeing how dangerous it is at the moment to literally be black, and that's a massive conversation that America should be having with itself.
Absolutely, and I'd add just one thing, because I think it's extremely important what you just said. That whole point that we were talking about earlier in the interview about people thinking that it was okay to tolerate this stuff and how that has to stop. When the film premiered at Sundance, and I know you were nervous about how it was going to be received, but then when it was over, and a standing ovation, and then you had Ron Davis come up, and I mean, it was a large enough theater, and people just... it ran through your body. There wasn't one person in the house sitting there going, "Ah." Everyone was really taken by this. And then Ron Davis gets up and he starts agitating about how this can no longer be tolerated. And he calls on people to put their hands up. If you're going to stand with him, if you're going to be out there fighting to end this, if you're not going to tolerate this anymore. And there wasn't one person that didn't put their hand up in that house. And I thought that was a really, really moving moment. And it seems that there is this kind of movement that started to grow. And I was wondering what you thought about that, both that moment and this, the growth of this movement.
Yeah, I will likely never forget that moment. And also it's very important because, you know, the type of people that were in that audience. And I think Ron mentioned recently to me that he was on a march in New York City where about 60, 70% of the people on the march, on a Black Lives Matter march, were white. And again, I think this is much a film for white audiences to understand or be invited to reflect upon their own biases, because this isn't just going to change by black people saying that Black Lives Matter. It's actually white people that have to understand their own implicit biases and racism and conscious racism and subconscious racism in themselves, let alone how, you know, that manifests throughout the whole system.
All right, Mark Silver, thank you very much for joining us today.
Cool, thank you.
All right, welcome back. That was Mark Silver, the director of just a very, very powerful film, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. And the film tells the story of the vicious, brutal, racist murder of Jordan Davis by a white man who thought he was entitled to do that, because that's what this society tells him. He's entitled to do that. They encourage that. Ron Davis is joining us to talk about his son, to talk about his thoughts since then. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's jump into this, because the questions I have, as I told you, the questions are, I spent a lot of time, I was deeply impacted by the film. I was deeply impacted by what I've read about what you've been doing, what you said. So I wanted to ask you this. You've spoken to how Jordan's humanity was stolen. People got to understand, Jordan Davis was a high school kid.
Yes.
He was a young teenager who liked music, who liked life. And he was full of hope, goals, ideas. And he was gunned down because of the color of his skin and the fact that he wasn't going to bow down and say yes, sir, to somebody.
Yes, and I taught him not to bow down and say yes, sir, to somebody. What happened with Trayvon Martin, me and Jordan, we talked about that. And Jordan couldn't understand why somebody would take it upon themselves to kill this kid for basically just going to the store buying Skittles and iced tea and just minding his own business and walking home. And so we had, again, that conversation with Jordan about there are people in the world. They're not just white people. They're white supremacists. There's a difference, and people have to realize we have people that want to go back to what they consider the good old days of the Confederacy. You have a lot of people that still have grandsons that they've taught this hate speech to. And so I told Jordan that even though he looked at like Trayvon, that he has to be equipped mentally to handle these things that are out there that's facing him as a child. He put on a brown hoodie, and they have a picture of him with that brown hoodie. And this young man, I'm proud that he fought back verbally. He respected Michael Dunn enough not to get out the car and try to cause harm to Michael Dunn. And that's one thing that Michael Dunn cannot lie about. Jordan never touched a hair on his head, never scratched his car. He never did anything physically to Michael Dunn. So Michael Dunn just, like the prosecutor said, he decided to kill Jordan. He didn't have to kill Jordan. But I'm proud of my son, and I'm proud of the legacy that we're going to leave.
Let me ask you this. Jordan's humanity was stolen in a lot of ways, both through the murder, but also in the courtroom, the whole process. They wouldn't let you show pictures of Jordan. They would let you show pictures of him interacting with his family or any of that stuff. You were allowed to see Dunn, the killer, as a human. You weren't allowed to see Jordan as anything but a one-dimensional character whose face was simply what? A driver's license ID.
That's right.
I want to ask you, I want you to have the chance now to tell people, the film restored the humanity of Jordan. It was a big part of what you see in that film. But also for you, you have spent a lot of time talking about the humanity of Jordan. Tell us what Jordan was like.
Jordan, even as a small child, when he was in the car seat, me and Lucy remember the days where we would put on music and drive into Atlanta proper. And he would just listen to the music, no big thing. He's in his car seat in the back. But all of a sudden, one day, I put on James Brown. Oh, my goodness. I put on James Brown. He just started dancing and dancing and dancing to this thing. And then we said, well, maybe it was just him getting ready to dance. So maybe if we put on another song of somebody else, maybe he'll still dance. So we put on another song. He stopped dancing. And we said, this kid loves James Brown. It was incredible. And I remember the first time that we had snowfall in Georgia. And I put little Jordan's snowsuit on, took him outside, and he looked at it like it was ice cream. So he picked it up, put it in his mouth, and he tastes good, and he smiled and everything, and he laughed. But then all of a sudden, he forgot that the snow was on his hands, and it started getting cold, and that smile turned into a frown, and I had to put his hands in my mouth to warm his hands up. These things, as a parent, that you see these children growing up. Jordan, he liked to roller skate, indoor roller skating. He loved to swim. He was a great swimmer. I'm a scuba diver. I'm a registered diver, but he loved to swim. And what we used to do in Jacksonville is go out to the waves right near the pier. And you'll see it in this film. You'll see a pier in Jacksonville. We used to go right out there and had a game called Jump the Waves. Every time the waves come, you turn your back and jump as many as you can before you get knocked down. And he won a lot of times. Even though I was taller than him, he still won a lot of times. So, you know, that's a special place in that film, and that's a special place in our hearts. My father, that was the last place he came to go to the beach. He got sick with bone cancer. He hadn't seen the beach in almost 20 years. And when he came to live with me the last 6 months of his life, he asked me to take him to the beach, and I took him to that same spot. Mm-hmm. So that's a very special spot for me. It's like three generations right there in that spot.
I was very moved by the statement that you made to the court after the trial was over. And I want to touch on that because people don't get the chance to actually hear what the impact of having a child murdered, whether it's by the police or a vigilante, having a child's life stolen. I want you to tell people what that's like.
The first time as a parent you get that call, you never forget the call. Leland, who's Jordan's best friend, felt blood on his hands. And Leland screamed out and called his mother on his cell phone and was crying and screaming to his mother. His mother called me. And that's why any friend that Jordan ever had, I always had their phone number of their parents. And I always tell parents, make sure who your kids hang out with and make sure you have their phone numbers in case of emergency. Thank God she had my number. She called me at work and told me to rush down to the hospital. And the thing that a parent doesn't know is that you hear that your son or daughter is shot, but you don't know if they survived. 30 minutes of driving to the hospital, not knowing whether he was dead or alive. I never forgot that. And when you got to the hospital, it took an hour for them to verify that it was Jordan that they had. The one thing that I tell people is that one of the worst periods of time in my life is sitting in my car when I got home from the hospital because nobody else knew but me and my family that Jordan was killed. I have to pull into my driveway and go in the house and tell my wife that her stepson is dead. Then I have to call Lucy, his mother, and tell her her son, her only son, is dead. And I sat in that car for probably about 20 minutes, I believe. And everything was quiet. It was deathly silent. Nobody was around. There was no cars, no nothing. It was just like going into a tunnel. And I had to tell these two ladies that we lost Jordan. And I would tell any parent out there, never, ever try to take your mind to even imagine losing a child because your brain would stop you from going that far. You can never imagine that pain of losing a child.
And you still have that pain today from what I've read in terms of even the watch that Jordan used to have, the things like that. You still have that. And that's important for people to understand because this stuff doesn't leave you.
Right. And it took me 2 years petitioning the court to get Jordan's ID. I have Jordan's ID right now in my pocket. And it took 2 years because everything is evidence. Everything could be overturned on appeal. So you have to also fight the court system to get that back from them. Just a piece of Jordan, his last moments on earth, I wanted his ID because it was with him when he took his last breath, and I finally got that from the court. And another thing about court is this. Never forget, it's not a trial of Jordan Davis. It's a trial of Michael Dunn. Jordan Davis and his family doesn't have any rights in that courtroom. You have to fight for every right that you get, so much so that the defense attorney had the nerve to put me on the witness list just to shut my mouth so I couldn't talk to the press. And he called me as a witness, and the respectful thing to do is to tell the prosecutor ahead of time the witnesses that you're going to call next so they can prepare. They didn't do that. The defense attorney decided one day, let's just grab Mr. Davis and all his grief and drag him up to this. And you don't see it in the film, but they actually called me in the first trial to the stand, and I wasn't even there, just to harass me as a father and hopefully that I'll say something to incriminate myself. And I wasn't even there.
You talked about going to Charleston, South Carolina recently. And yes. One of the things I read that you said was that you shared a lot with the people there. The commonality of facing up to white supremacy that underlies these murders. Can you talk about that a little?
When I do the Q&A and the films and I go across this country and I tell the audiences that I have that people that are not of color, they have to also fight against white supremacy because these are the people that are trying to tear the fabric of this nation apart. They want the good old days, the Confederate flag and what that means to them. And they try to lie and say it's about heritage. It's not about heritage. It's about enslaving a people, a race of people, for monetary gain. They built their whole lives and their bank accounts from the back of the slaves. And they want to continue that. And that's what it's all about. And that's why when we had the Civil War, it was about slavery. They try to lie and say it's about everything else under the sun. But the main thing it was about was because the Southern states still wanted to have slavery, and they have not gotten over that yet. And so I went to Charleston, South Carolina. 2 days ago, I came back from Charleston. And when I was there, I called Walter Scott's father, Walter Scott Sr. His son was killed by getting shot in the back by a policeman. And then the policeman tried to put a taser next to the body, but another policeman saw him and told him not to do that. This was all caught on videotape. This is happening in the South and happening in states across this nation, that the police are using their powers not to protect and to serve, but to discriminate against people of color. And so that's why we need what happened in Charleston to be focused on. These people forgave the shooter. That just shows you that African-Americans over the course of decades have forgiven so many injustices that have been done to them. The Tuskegee experiment in Alabama, where you had given people of color syphilis on purpose. You know, so many things that they've done to us, and we keep forgiving and forgiving. There's going to be a point where we're going to stop forgiving. And that's what the white supremacists want us to come to that and have a race war. But people out there, I tell you, I think there's much more good people in this world than there are bad people.
Well, let me ask you this. You warned, actually, Walter Scott's parents, too, about this. You talked about the way that there's always an attempt to victimize the victim. And you said, don't victimize the victim. I want you to talk about that, because that's something that's very important in terms of all this other stuff that you've been talking about.
Right.
Let's talk about that.
Well, that's why it's so unique, because, you know, when you have the Trayvon, they try to say marijuana. When you had the Eric Garner, we had loose cigarettes. You know, we had this other Walter Scott. Well, he was running away from a cop. He was trying to get his taser. It's always an excuse. But does any of those things come to murder? Does any of the things where you have to lose a life? And this is what I'm talking about with Jordan, is that they couldn't victimize Jordan because of the fact that Jordan didn't have marijuana in his system. Jordan didn't have alcohol in his system. Jordan wasn't a gangster. Jordan wasn't a gangster rapper. Jordan went to school. Jordan has never been arrested. Jordan has never been to prison. So Michael Dunn actually, you know, he picked the wrong group of kids to do this because Jordan wasn't all those things. And I think America saw a kid that said, you know what, that could have been my child. That could have been my child, because Jordan was all these things that America say you have to be. You have to be that way.
You know, one thing, though, and I have to say this because you've also had some ongoing contact with Trayvon Martin's dad,
yes,
and with the parents and families of other people who've been killed by the police. And it's one of the things I think is really important about what you're doing with your life now.
Right.
But it's also this point of they do this thing where they always make it seem like, even though you can testify to what Jordan was about, they do this thing where they basically end up saying, well, yeah, but. And you don't know what he was like. He did call that man names, or that Trayvon, you know. What was he doing walking out there? Come on, you know. But it was always that thing about victimizing the victim where somehow they try to twist it and make it seem it's the victim's fault.
Right. Everything that has been happening across this nation, you have to realize that these killings, no matter whether it's from a citizen or law enforcement, the person that's the victim is unarmed. Why is that all the time? It's always unarmed. When was the last time you heard a national story where one of these victims was armed? Never. You know, Rakia Boyd, unarmed girl, got shot in the face by a shotgun. Unarmed. Tamira Rice, unarmed.
A 12-year-old kid.
12-year-old kid. John Crawford, he goes into Walmart. Guess what? Walmart sells guns. You can't pick up a gun where they sell guns. Unarmed. He's armed with a BB gun. So all these cases are unarmed kids. So I think that there's murderous intent. There's people that are with some of these organizations that are white supremacist organizations that we found out that they're in law enforcement. And so it's not the blue shield anymore. I think the good policemen should go ahead and pull down that blue wall and start telling on the policemen that are doing wrong. And that's what's breaking our country up.
You know what I've learned over the years? One thing, the police are here not to serve the people at all. That's not their job. They're here to protect the system, and particularly the capital system. They're here to protect the system that right. has unleashed 400 years of the most barbaric oppression right. against black people.
Thanks.
So even if a cop wants to look and say, hey, this is wrong,
right.
the choice he has is to leave or become part of the machine that's doing all this. And that's the thing, because you're never going to change the police. The police are not just sort of misguided. They are beasts. You know,
well, they're part of mass incarceration. Right. We fight against mass incarceration also with all these private prisons. And now if you look at CCA, they're on the stock mm-hmm. exchange where they're making money hand over fist. And that's why I tell them, look at the 13th and 14th Amendment when they say we abolish slavery
yeah.
except in the event that it's a form of punishment. And that's why they still have ongoing slavery right now today mm-hmm. by having mass incarceration, 2.2 million people incarcerated, and most of them, 67%, are people of color.
Mm-hmm. Ron, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you so much, man. I want to tell you that, you know, you've got a lot of people, myself included, people who listen to this, standing with you, man. And we will be there. And not the question that we have your back, but we got to be there on the front lines with you.
Well, make sure you look at our website, which is walkwithjordan.org. That's our website. And go on that site and keep up with us. And also see our film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets.
And as I understand it, the film is currently touring cities around the country, so you might be able to find it coming to your city. And if not, it will be airing on HBO sometime this coming fall. Ron, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Edward Baptist to talk about more on the same subject. So stay tuned.
No matter what you do, don't you die a slave. Up against a single wall, like we're meant for nothing better than catching a goddamn ball. Get a load of the worldwide military.
All right, welcome back. That was Georgia Ann Muldrow with Brother Like Giselle. All right, and joining us now to continue this conversation is Edward Baptist. And Edward, I featured earlier this year in January, I featured him, and Edward is the author of the book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be back.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back, and I want to have you back a lot more, but I also was moved to have you back because you wrote an editorial piece that just knocked my socks off, and I think it's extremely important that people look at this, and especially as we've been talking about the entire show,
this kind of slaughter, this kind of heinous crimes committed against people of color in this country. The title of your op-ed piece was Forgiveness in Charleston Isn't Absolution for 400 Years of Racial Violence in America. Give people a sense of what you were talking about there.
Well, I got the sense, and a lot of other people did as well, that the victims' families' willingness to step forward and tell Dylann Roof that they forgave him, which I think was part of their own process and really their own, really a private process in a way, even though it was done in public, that it gave too many people the sense in this country that we didn't really have to confront the causes, the wider societal causes that lead to the kind of violence that we saw in Charleston last week. So I didn't want to participate in letting people off the hook, letting me off the hook, letting anybody else off the hook for that. I think we need to confront the larger causes, the larger sorts of issues that, for instance, the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to confront.
Yeah, well, and what do you bring out? And I thought this was extremely important because there's only a few places that actually tackle it this way, where you actually put it in terms of you can't overcome basically centuries of dehumanization and murder, violence on which this entire system we live in is based on through reconciliation. And you know, everybody always looks at, oh, well, peace and reconciliation in South Africa, reconciliation here, reconciliation there. But in every one of those cases, the crimes are just like pushed aside or whitewashed, and it doesn't really achieve anything for the people except somehow accepting the way things are.
Well, I think you have to change the realities, the social and economic and political realities that are the outcome of those 400 years. If you look at the case of South Africa, it's very problematic. I mean, you have the Truth and Reconciliation Committees, and we've never had something like that in this country, or only on very limited scales. And yet, despite all the good work that the people who participated in that process have done, at the end of the day, there's a shift in political power to the majority, but economic power remains with the white minority in South Africa. There's simply a huge amount of social conflict because of that fact, because you've still got these massive kind of inequities. And we've got inequities that in their own way are parallel to that here. And we are simply not going to address them by saying, isn't it great that the victims' families have forgiven the killer? That's really a private process. That's them working through their grief. But if we want to do something that will help make it less likely this sort of event will happen again or other sorts of events will happen again, we've got our own work that we have to do.
Now, you refer to something you call Walmart grace. Tell me what that is.
Right. So that really that comes about from thinking a little bit, and again, with the help of a lot of other people who are talking about this issue, about the concept of grace. And of course, the victims' families are working with a concept of grace and forgiveness that comes from Christianity. Not surprisingly, the victims were members of the AME Church, and so that's the kind of language they're going to be speaking in. And working in that language, I thought back to some things I'd read in the distant past, and some other people were doing this too, I should point out, like the journalist Jamel Bowie. What I thought back to was the writings of the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who criticized the idea of cheap grace. And there's a difference between free grace and cheap grace. Free grace is granted by God. It's not something that people really have any control over. But Bonhoeffer said, too often what we want is not free grace, which should demand a response on our part, but what we want is cheap grace, which is grace that comes without any rethinking of what we have done and what we are continuing to do, that puts us in the position of needing to be forgiven for something. And what's cheaper than Walmart?
But, well, there's more to it, too, though, because, you know, you also talk about this whole point of, we'll put it this way, you say, and it's that point you were just saying, my fellow white Americans, the killer remains at large and the killer is us. And that's something that is never spoken to in this kind of a situation.
Yeah, although the preacher from this past Sunday at Riverside Church, Reverend Barber, mm-hmm. did that. And he's got an op-ed out now that's, as I understand, basically the text of the sermon. And that's his... You know, that's his kind of hook. That's his line. The perpetrator was caught last Thursday, and yet the killer is still at large. And the killer is the set of attitudes that in this country ensures that on some level black lives don't matter in the way that we run our society. Black lives too often don't matter when we think about how policing and criminal justice should take place in the society. They don't matter when we think about how mass incarceration works in this society, where you've got millions of people behind bars, disproportionate number of them black and brown. And it's as if the fact that large numbers of them may be innocent, they may be the victims of over-policing, they may be framed for their crimes, or they may be given these absurdly long sentences for their crimes. Their lives are being literally locked up, being spent locked up. And yet this doesn't matter to us as much as it should. So these kinds of attitudes cheapen the lives of African Americans in the views of our society and our culture far too often. Obviously, lots of people criticize those facts, criticize those attitudes. Many white people criticize those attitudes. But there's always more work that we need to do to actually combat those attitudes, combat those policies, and change those realities.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Edward Baptist, the author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. And we're talking about Ed's recent op-ed piece in the LA Times titled, Forgiveness in Charleston Isn't Absolution for 400 Years of Racial Violence in America.
One question I have, because of the book that you wrote, and which I told you when I interviewed you, was one of the best books I've read in a very, very long time. But you actually showed how the whole issue of slavery, the whole reality of slavery, and by extension, the whole reality of the continued slavery-based oppression and repression of black people in America, that this is actually, you know, this is something that was like really endemic to this system. And I think that's something that really has to be tackled when you're talking about getting behind the root cause of it and how do you get beyond that. You know, you're dealing with something that is, as you said, 400 years of violence, but it's at the same time, this racist violence, at the same time, it's rooted in something and a system that required the most repulsive system in the history of humanity, the slave system, actually was used to build this. And it was part and parcel of this whole thing, of the foundation of it. That's a big thing to deal with in relation to all this.
Yeah. I mean, the words that supposedly Dylann Roof said when he was asked, you know, why are you doing this to us, when he was shooting people in the church basement. You know, he said, you're taking over our country, right? You are taking over our country, as if their ancestors had not probably been in this country longer than his. And you're raping our women. And first of all, most of the people he's shooting are women who are far older than him. I mean, it's absurd on the face of it. But what he's really talking about is a much deeper and wider belief, an anxiety about somehow black people are going to take over the country. You saw this after both of Obama's elections. You saw this surge of that sort of anxiety and an anxiety about sexual violence. And you find both of those anxieties repeated again and again and again in the antebellum era every time there's a scare about a slave rebellion. And we could talk to psychologists about the ways in which this is, you know, a kind of a transference of the guilt maybe that some of the whites were actually doing those things to enslaved African Americans, that they're sort of projecting it on enslaved African Americans. And I'm sure there's something to that. But this sort of script of talking about the relationship between white and black America, that white America feels it has to police and fear black America, that starts in slavery. And it starts because of the nature of enslavement. And it's continued. You can watch it continue in the discussions about Reconstruction. You can watch it continue throughout the Jim Crow era. These anxieties are constantly called up every time that there's a lynching. And it continues through the Civil Rights era. So that discourse, if we can call it that, is deeply, deeply ingrained as a way that large numbers of white people in this country are encouraged to relate to African Americans collectively.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ed, we have about, a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go on this. I want you to talk about atonement, because you posed that at the very end of your piece, and this question of atonement and what you mean by that and why it's so important.
Well, I mean, atonement is a great big theological concept, and I'm not a theologian, but as I understand it, it means doing things maybe not to merit forgiveness, but to show that you intend to behave in ways that merit forgiveness. And this means taking risks, putting yourself in the place of those who have been wronged, those who you have wronged, whether individually or collectively, suffering with them, suffering in some sense for the sins that you have committed. And this could take all kinds of forms. I think that when whites take risks to participate in social movements that involve, that are about African-American freedom, African-American liberation, in some cases, they're certainly taking real risks. Sometimes they might not be the same as the risks that African-Americans are taking, but they often are quite real risks. And sometimes this is also going to have to be about being quiet and listening to those who have been wronged, instead of trying to silence African-American voices, instead of being too fragile to hear about what has happened in the past, too fragile to hear about what has been the result of white violence and plunder over time, being strong enough to actually listen to and hear the voices that are talking about that, that could be a kind of atonement or the beginning of a process of atonement. And I think that that is what we need to turn towards instead of reacting to criticism, reacting to the events in such a way that in particular for whites, that they shut off or try to shut off discussion. That's simply futile and it's destructive in its own right.
All right, Edward Baptist, we got to wrap it up right now because we're just running out of time. Okay. But really, thank you very much for joining us today and look forward to having you back, all right?
All right, thanks for having me on.
Sure, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Professor Edward Baptist, the author of The Half Has Never Been Told, all right? It's a really great new book. And if you want to get that, if you want to hear the interview I did with him back in January, you can find that on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com. Michael Slate. I want to read you something real quick before we go out, and then I'm just going to have to say thank you to everybody that made this show possible today. This is from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. There is the potential for something of unprecedented beauty to arise out of unspeakable ugliness. Black people playing a crucial role in putting an end at long last to this system, which has for so long not just exploited, but dehumanized, terrorized, and tormented them in a thousand ways. Putting an end to this in the only way it can be done, by fighting to emancipate humanity, to put an end to the long night in which human society has been divided into masters and slaves, and the masses of humanity have been lashed, beaten, raped, slaughtered, shackled, and shrouded in ignorance and misery. All right, and once again, that's a statement by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I played this because I could not think at all of anything more appropriate, more fitting for what we've been talking about all through today's show. And you can find it for yourself, print it out, spread it around at revcom.us. Okay, that brings us to the end of yet another show. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Federico Garcia. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a piece from Jasiri X called Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder. Talk to you again next week. Even though we got the ballot, where's Malcolm, where's Chewy?